It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Hi, everyone. This week on 30 with Murdy, I chat with actor Nick Turturro. Nick is most well known for his role as Detective James Martinez on NYPD Blue for 7 seasons, starting in 1993. Nick was nominated for 2 Emmy Awards for that role and won a SAG Award with the cast for Best Ensemble. He's appeared in dozens of other projects, too, on film, TV, a native New Yorker, and a big, super crazy Yankees fan. His brother John Turturro is also a very accomplished actor, and John's actually one of my favorite movies of all time, Quiz Show, the Robert Redford-directed film about the game show scandal in the late 50s. I got to meet Nick about 12 years ago when he appeared in Adam Sandler's remake of The Longest Yard, and have spoken to him enough over the years to get a feel for his passion as a baseball fan. I thought he'd make a real interesting conversation, and he sure did. Among the highlights of our talk, Nick discussed his career as a doorman at the St. Moritz on Central Park South. Right next door used to be Mickey Mantle's restaurant, where in the early days of WFAN, Ed Coleman and Dave Sims used to host live broadcasts. Imagine their surprise when the guy who used to watch their cars while they did their show went on to become a TV star. Some fun memories from Nick that also feature some stories with Mickey Mantle and Billy Joel. Nick has some great stories about being at Yankee Stadium for some memorable games. You'll hear that too, as well as a harrowing tale that I'd never heard before about the 1994 Northridge earthquake in L.A. Some riveting details from Nick about this one. Nick will also talk about his new project called Over the Hill and where we might see that in the near future. It was my pleasure to have Nick Turturro spend a little over 30 with Murdy. My first question to everybody, Nicky, is what can you tell me about the first baseball game you ever went to?
First baseball game I ever went to was 1973. No, actually, that's the first Yankee game. The first baseball game I ever went to, I believe, was in 1972 at Shea Stadium. And the funniest thing about that game that I remember, I don't know who the Mets played. I was new to baseball because my family wasn't baseball fans. My brother, John, was a basketball, boxing fan. My father loved boxing. So we grew up, I actually was a pretty good point guard. I just didn't grow, but I was a good point guard. But baseball, I started watching a little bit in 71. I remember on NBC, I remember the World Series. I remember the Orioles playing the Pirates, and I saw Roberto Clemente. So I started to watch baseball a little bit. I didn't even know how to play baseball. You know, a couple of my friends who were Puerto Rican, whatever, they taught me a little bit. And I went to a Met game in 72, and I was afraid of heights. I was definitely afraid of heights. And when I was with a bunch of kids, and I was sitting in the mezzanine, they had no idea how many fears I had. I had all kinds of fears. I had fear of heights. I had fear of going to the bathroom. I mean, these were real fears. I mean, we went to a Knick game where I was crying, and my mother had to take me and my brother down. So I was at the Met game, and it was windy, and I was in the blue mezzanine, which was pretty high, and I was panicking, and all my friends were laughing, giggling. I'm holding on to the seat.
Wow.
I mean, I couldn't even enjoy the baseball game. So that was my first introduction to a baseball game. I just remember telling these guys, please take me down, please. And for whatever reason, you know how kids are, they're mean.
Yeah,
like when I was afraid to go in the pool, I would hold on to the side, and everybody would try to get me off the side. So I think they left me up there for a while before we ever, like, snuck down or something. Because back in those days, you would buy $1.50, $1.30, whatever the grandstand seat was, and you would run around, find a seat, and then the usher would say, hey, kid, get up. Mm-hmm. And you would just keep looking for seats, because it wasn't like today. It was a different world.
Yeah.
That was my first game. I don't remember who the Mets played, but I definitely wasn't a Mets fan, because when I went to the old Yankee Stadium in 73, the next year, I walked in with the Boy Scouts of America, and I was just, like, blown away by the smell, by the look of the ballpark, and the Yankees weren't that great back then. They had Bobby Mercer. They had Thurman Munson. They were kind of a fun team to watch, and I don't know what it was, but I wound up going to a lot of games that year. I went to Bat Day. I went to Hat Day or Ball Day, and I started going to the Bronx. I was from Queens, which I really should have been Mets fan by landscape. But I just fell in love with the Yankees and started to educate myself. But I remember the Met game being afraid of heights, but that was it.
Yeah.
And I do remember going to Yankee Stadium a lot in 73. I didn't go to the final game where everybody went with hammers and nails. And
yeah.
I wish I would have, but I'm really sad that I only got to go 1 year to that stadium.
Yeah.
Because that was something else.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I think you've told me that you were at the first big moment in the remodeled stadium was the Chris Chambliss game in 76. You were there, weren't you?
Yes, I was there. But that was the renovated, that was the reopening of yep. Yankee Stadium. Because 74, 75, they played at Shea.
Yeah. What do you remember about the craziness of that moment with Chambliss hitting the home run that wins the pennant in 76?
Oh, that was an insane game, insane night. I'll never forget where I was. I was down the left field line.
How old were you at the time?
I was in high school.
Okay.
I think I was a freshman in high school at St. Agnes Cathedral in Long Island. And I remember my mother let me go because my friend Anthony Ingracia got tickets that day. His father had connections, and his father was an accountant. And he called me up and he was like, "Totoro, we're going!" And I was like, "Yeah!" It was supposed to be me, Ingracia, and this guy, Louis Alvario. And Louis Alvario's father loved baseball, but wouldn't let him go to the game that night. And I said, you can't go? And he was like, no, my father said I can't go. I said, how could he say no? This is a new thing. I mean, I'd never been to a game like that of that. Who knew that it was going to be that kind of moment?
Yeah.
I didn't know that it was going to be that wild. And I think the ticket was like $8. I think I have the ticket somewhere. And I think it was $8. We were down the left field line. And all I know is when he hit the ball, the whole place rose, and I dove from like left field near the foul pole. And I was running with a euphoria that was like, I mean, it was like almost unbelievable, the most almost unbelievable out of body, like you came out of your body. You know, I can't tell you the euphoria of running and then ripping out grass and running with the turf in my hand. And I had to make a 1 o'clock train, I remember, because if I missed the 1 o'clock train back to Rosedale, I was stuck till 4 a.m. But it was like probably the greatest Yankee moment. As great as the Reggie game was, and I was at that game too.
Yeah.
But the Chambliss moment was like, that was like the crowning moment of being like, I'd only been a fan like 3 years, 4 years, but I felt like I was a Yankee fan for life. And it was just a marvelous night. Like the Yankee season should have ended. We got swept. That was our highlight. That was like, and then the freaking National League and the Reds embarrassed us. But I don't even care about that. That was almost like comparable to 2003, the Aaron Boone. In a lot of ways, when you have a moment that high, you're flat as a button. You can't get higher than that. And for that team, that was like when the Mariners beat the Yankees. That was their World Series. It happens. And that was an incredible moment, man. That was a great game. Mickey Rivers had a great game. Freaking George Brett hits a home run.
Yeah.
Freaking George Brett. I couldn't stomach him. He had a home run off of Grant Jackson. I remember specifically.
Anywhere near Chambliss during your whole, when you got onto the field, you didn't anywhere near the infield and Chambliss and all the players, did you?
No, I was nowhere near the infield. I was on my way from the outfield. If you see highlights of people running in packs from the outfield, I'm one of those guys. I found a picture of myself in Sports Illustrated because I had like a green coat and I had an orange hood.
Wow.
And I was like, there I am in skinny legs. I was like, that's me. I remember showing people because they were like, Nick is on the field.
That's great.
And everybody was cursing out Howard Cosell. I think everybody was like looking up at Howard Cosell and saying things to Howard. You know, it was a different world back then.
Yeah.
It really was a different game. It doesn't have the same bite or same edge today as it did in the 70s.
Did you remember what you did with the grass that you took or anything like that?
Oh, no, I planted it in my backyard. Yeah, it was a true story. I planted it in my backyard, and I had a Yankee pennant. I had a little turf there. And actually, I was telling that story once when I was newly on NYPD Blue, and the creator, David Mills, goes, "Is that true, Nicky?" And I said, yeah. He goes, can I use that? Can I use that? And they actually used a little bit of it. And, I said, yeah, I don't care. If you want to take the story a little bit. And he actually implemented a little bit of that in the storyline.
That's fantastic. Before we get to how you got to NYPD Blue, you had a job as a valet at the St. Moritz, and one of the guys you parked cars for was Ed Coleman?
Yeah, no, I was a doorman.
Okay.
I wasn't a valet. I was the doorman of the St. Moritz on the park, and I used to like 59th Street. You know 59th Street? It's like one of the famous streets in New York, Central Park South. I was right on the corner of 6th Avenue. It was a very famous place, actually, for the Yankees. I had no idea the history.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Martin, Mickey Mantle, who were big drunks, but they used to hang out there.
Yeah.
And they lived there, and they caroused there. So there was a lot of history with old Yankee players in the St. Moritz. It's just funny that I wound up at the St. Moritz.
Yeah.
I got this job. Actually, it's a funny story how I got the job through this. I was a bellhop one summer, and I loved the money, but then I went back to school, and I was missing the money. And then when I was looking for a job, I called the St. Moritz, and I asked for the general manager. It was the same general manager who hired me at the Harley Hotel. And he said, they said, well, who are you? And I said, Nick Turturro. And they said, well, what company are you from? And I had to use my father's company because my father worked, built an apartment for the guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was in construction. So the guy, Flaherty, gets on the phone thinking it's my dad. He goes, hi, Nick, how are you? So I had to lower my voice. And I basically said, do you remember my son? Oh, yeah, sure. He goes, well, he's looking for a little something. So he said, well, send him over. So this guy, Flaherty, who was like a sharp guy, sharp Irish guy, he hired me. My father was dying laughing. I said, I got food to Flaherty, Dad. He goes, yeah? How? I said, I told him I was you. You told him that you were me? Because he was Nick Turturro the first. I'm Nick Turturro Jr. Because we'd always have a running gag about senior and junior. My father was hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Hilarious. He didn't know he was hilarious. He'd get the mail and he'd say, are you junior? And I'd say, yeah. He goes, because I'm senior. Because you're junior, right? I go, yeah, I'm junior. He would say this 25 times. He goes, because I'm senior. Just remember, you're junior, right? I go, yeah, I'm junior, Dad. Make sure you put junior. Junior. I go, okay. So it worked in my favor, using his name that time.
Yeah.
But where am I? So, yeah, I was a doorman, part-time doorman at the St. Moritz. Then I became a full-time doorman. So I used to run the street. I used to say I'd run the street, but 59th Street South, and they had Mickey Mantle's.
Yep.
And they started doing a live talk show there. I think it was WFAN.
Yes.
I wasn't even a WFAN fan then.
Okay.
But Ed Coleman and who's the other guy? Dave Sims.
Yep.
These guys used to show up with not the greatest cars. I like to watch good cars, But I liked the guys. They were nice guys, and they used to, they used to tip me $5-$10. I would let them put the car in the hotel loaning zone because basically I could control the cops if it was in my, That's how I used to make extra money.
Okay.
So I watched their cars and blah, blah, blah. And, I think when I started my little acting career, I started telling Eddie and those guys,
yeah,
hey, I did a play. Hey, I was in a movie because I had kept my job while I began my career, the first couple of years of my acting career. I was still a doorman. So, I do remember. In fact, I might have even gone on the air once with Eddie,
really?
One of those guys, because I did a play. I did these plays with Boom Boom Mancini, and Ray was trying to be an actor, and we did these funny plays in the village. And I think, since Ray was a celebrity, I think, Eddie or Dave might have had me on the show. I might have came on. I mean, I used to watch a lot of the games from the window.
Yeah.
A lot of times they'd say, where's the doorman? And they say, you see the guy watching the baseball game? That's your doorman. I would literally be in front of Mickey Mantle's, or sometimes I'd be down by the plaza. They would have arrows pointing, people would check in. They'd say, where's the doorman? They say, that guy down the block. I used to leave my post for various reasons,
But it was
really a fun job.
I remember Eddie Coleman telling me one time that he's sitting watching TV with his wife, and he's watching NYPD Blue, and he sees you on. He's like, wait a second, I think that's Nicky who parks my car, watches my car, Mickey Mantle's.
That's very funny, because when I first got on NYPD Blue, Dennis Franz comes up to me, and I didn't know Dennis, even though he was a TV star from Hill Street Blues, and I used to stop everybody. And one time I stopped one of his buddies, Joe Montaigne. Mm-hmm. My brother was up and coming then, my brother John. And I used to talk to people, and I'd ask them, do they know who my brother is? And I think I stopped Joe Montaigne one time and introduced myself. The guy must have had a good memory. Because, you know, sometimes you remember a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was newly on Blue, I was a nervous wreck. I was just like, oh, man, I hope I'm, you know, all these guys were seasoned guys. And I could tell I was like in the big leagues, you know. It was like, you know, like you're in the minor leagues, then you get a call up. And you go, wow, I hope I can hang. It really was the big leagues for me and for anybody, because it was like the top writers, the top directors in television. And Dennis comes up to me with that Chicago accent, and he's like, hey, Nicky. He goes, were you ever a doorman? He goes, because a buddy of mine swears you were a doorman. Joe Montaigne. Yeah, I was. I said, I actually stopped Joe. And he was like, yeah, because I think he remembers you, because I met that kid in the street. So, you know, I met some ball players too. I remember I met Cohn. I met Andy Hawkins. I mean, I met the world out there. I met a lot of athletes. Entertainers. I became good friends with Billy Joel. I was actually mentioned in Billy Joel's book that I was a struggling young actor. Billy Joel loved me. He wrote a whole album there. And when he met Christy Brinkley and his first date, I was with him on his first date.
Wow.
I mean, I was coaching him. You know, I was coaching him. He was like, who should I go out with? Elle McPherson or Christy Brinkley? I was like, well, you can't lose, Bill. You know, he was so excited. And I was like, no, so what are you so excited? I said, you're Billy Joel. You're Billy Joel, man. And he was like, yeah, you're right. Like, forget these girls. I said, yeah, remember who you are. He was like, he loved me. He'd come down. Sometimes I'd have 20 people waiting for a cab. Everybody would start screaming because I would put Billy in the front. I'd say, hey, take it easy. It's Billy Joel.
Yeah.
Oh, you had to see me in action. I mean, I had like a whole routine. It was pretty funny.
Did you, the St. Moritz, you mentioned the history it has with Mickey Mantle. Mickey Mantle's restaurant in Central Park South was right next door, and Mickey used to go in there quite a bit. Did you ever have any interactions with Mantle during that time?
Yeah, one morning about 7 o'clock, and on the weekends I used to work like 7 to 3:30. Weekdays I'd work 3:30 to 12. So I'd come out one morning. I used to come out 7 a.m. Saturday morning. You know, the only thing that's out there is pigeons and the horse and carriage. And I'm over there at 7 o'clock in the morning, like, you know, you're kind of half asleep. You get your coffee, just to put my coffee in my box. And there's a guy pitching pennies against the wall. I turn around, because you never know who the hell you were going to meet there. I turn around, and I was like, holy mackerels, it's Mickey Mantle. And I was like, wow. And he's over there, you know. He's like, I didn't want to be like too, because I heard he had kind of a, at times I'd heard stories he wasn't always the nicest guy. Maybe sometimes he was drunk and kids would ask him for his autograph. So I didn't want to be too strong with him. But we talked a little bit. I remember, you know, he was waiting for some lady or something. Then I was asking him, I said, you know, what do you think about the ball players today, Mickey, you know, versus when you played, you know? He goes, well, you know, because they're bigger, stronger, faster. You know, he was kind of complimenting the guys in that era. Versus when he played. But I was looking at him, and I was just like, I was kind of blown away just to be, it was me and Mickey Mantle pitching pennies. I was like, wow, this is, who would have thought it? You know, I was like, I mean, like, you never knew who I was going to be next. But, like, one time I watched John Gotti's car. I was like, wow, John Gotti came out. He was, like, bigger than any movie star. And, you know, it's like, I met so many people there. It was just like, it was crazy. I saw Billy Martin one time, but I didn't actually talk to him. He had sunglasses on.
Mm-hmm.
And he was another guy that I really wanted to talk to, but he looked like he was looked out of his mind. So I was like, I'm not gonna even approach Billy Martin. So I wanted to, but you know, sometimes I knew how to, you know, not make a fool out of myself. So I would, you know, I'd hold back. But Mickey was okay. I mean, he wasn't the friendliest chap in the world, but it was fascinating, you know, being outside with me and Mickey Mantle. It was like you never know who I was gonna meet. I met the president out there. It was crazy.
So how did you handle...
In fact, I did meet the president.
You did?
I worked for Trump.
Oh, there you go.
The whole one time. So it was funny. Donald Trump, you know, he actually owned the hotel when he met Marla Maples.
The Plaza.
I won't go into that story. But I actually was on Drew Carey with him and Marla. And he came over to me, and, you know, he made out like he knew me, like we were best friends. I'm so proud of you. You made it, kid. You made it. I was like Trump. I was way ahead of the curve with Trump.
Wow.
So who knew that Trump was never going to be the president?
As you're trying to break into acting, you know, you had some small roles in Spike Lee movies, and you mentioned some of the plays. Once you break it big on NYPD Blue, it's one of the biggest hits on TV. And for people who don't remember, you know, this is still back in the day, early 90s, when, you know, the three network model was still in effect. I mean, people were watching, there were only three different things that people were going to watch on TV. And if you're on a hit show, everybody knows who you are. How did you handle that sudden burst? Because NYPD Blue was very out front. It was a hit right away, and all of you guys became famous just like that. How was that to deal with?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, because in a lot of ways, you know, here I was, this guy who was front and center. I was a doorman for 10, 11 years. I was a part-time actor for like 3 or 4 years, and I was doing very well doing it on the sort of like 50-50, and people were saying, wow, you're getting more and more jobs, you're getting better and better. I was sort of working up to a point where I was going to say, well, I'm either going to be a full-time actor and give this a chance, or obviously I don't want to be a doorman the rest of my life. It was a lot of fun. So I had gotten a little taste of being in some movies, getting some notoriety, getting an agent. But the year before I got NYPD Blue, I actually got a pilot to CBS. It was a sitcom. And I went out to L.A. I remember they tested me, and I was walking around in a powder blue leisure suit. And it was a fun experience. It was a live sitcom, and I had a great week, like a fantasy week. They paid me, like, you know, big money to be in a pilot. Well, whatever it was, I remember it was like 17 grand. And I was like, oh, wow, maybe this is my big break. And then the show didn't go, didn't get picked up. A lot of pilots don't get picked up. So I figured, that's probably my Hollywood experience. Not knowing a year later, I almost didn't get an audition for NYPD Blue. We had to fight hard because I wasn't Hispanic, and this woman wouldn't let me in the room. But anyway, I got the audition, and they made me wait months. They liked me enough to finally give me the job. And, you know, and the money was really, it was not great at the beginning, but my agent, everybody told me, he said, listen, this show's going to be huge. You have no idea. I really didn't go in with, I didn't even know how good the script was. I just was kind of going in like saying, hey, this is an opportunity for me. So I resigned, I gave up my job, and people were telling me, you know, some producers were like, you know, don't unpack your badge yet, kid, you know. You might get a year or two out of it. So I didn't know. I had 7 episodes out of 13 guaranteed, which meant really I could have, if they didn't like me in the first 13 episodes, they could have gotten rid of me. They liked me enough to say, wow, you know, we're going to make you a regular. I said, I thought I was a regular. That's what I thought. I was a series. I didn't really know. And then I wound up doing 20 out of 22 the first year. And this show just, it was really incredible, because I had never seen, people were telling me, this publicist girl said, it's going to be huge. And it was huge. I mean, I remember going to a Knick game with my brother that winter. I came home, and yeah, the whole world kind of knew John at that time.
Yeah.
But in a matter of months, because this show was being watched by everybody, not like network TV today, people don't even watch it.
Yeah.
Someone's watching it, but I'm saying it's not like you just said it. There wasn't HBO, there wasn't any of this stuff, and there wasn't Netflix. We were kind of the kings of the, you know, we were like the Yankees. We were like a championship team.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I was like, and I couldn't believe the, like, you know, after the show every Tuesday, the phone would ring. You'd go out. The whole world knew you, and people were noticing. And you know, I think it was I think I was so concentrated on doing what I was doing. You know, you get caught up in the hype a little bit, and you can be seduced by it on a certain level. But you don't realize how rare I think that might be. That you may never be in something like that again. Not to say you won't be successful, but it was a kind of a rare moment, knowing all the ups and downs I've faced in the last 20, 25 years. Those years were you know, it was an amazing ride, and pretty, like, unbelievable. You know, going from here, you know, people knew me in the street, to now, wow, all of a sudden I was like a celebrity or a household name. Yeah. And I'd only been working at it 3 or 4 years. I wasn't at it for like 10 years. I mean, I had been at it a short time. I had gotten a lot of results, which is impressive.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I must be doing something right, you know? So people were like, well, you're talented. But I think I was also developing myself on the show because, you know, I was learning while I was on it. Because I was still new at it. I was still learning my craft because I more or less learned on the job. I had some training, but I didn't have the kind of training my brother had and other people had. So, I mean, it was hard to believe. First year, I was nominated for an Emmy,
yeah.
And the show was a hit. It was a special time. You know, I met my wife later on. I mean, you know, so many things. I lived through the earthquake. So many things happened to me. I mean, my whole life was like I fell in love. I was a TV star. I almost got killed in an earthquake.
Whoa.
A lot of stuff happened to me, man. It was like really like a wild first couple of years, but exciting. I mean, in a lot of ways, I go, wow, that was my prime, you know? That was the prime of my life. Now it's all downhill.
which earthquake is this, Nikki?
This is the 94 Northridge earthquake that was like a, you know, 7.0, but in my area, it was like a 9-something.
Wow.
It happened at 4:31 in the morning, and I almost got killed. The building almost came down. I mean, it couldn't make it out of the building. I thought the building was coming down.
What happened? Tell me more about that.
It was crazy, man. All I remember is it was like somebody, you know, you've had bad dreams. Everybody's had nightmares. I'm still having nightmares. I mean, you know, you wake up screaming, yelling. This was for real. This was like somebody coming into your bedroom with a knife or like, say, a truck comes flying into your bedroom. The violence of the shaking, I can't even describe what was going on. I just remember the sound of it, like something started. A week before, I remember watching a game in my apartment going, football game, oh, we had a minor earthquake. I was like, oh, wow, that's cool. I remember that day, it was a balmy day. I didn't know what was coming down. But I can't describe how it went side to side, up and down, like an explosion. I mean, you know, I imagine people that when they were in, you know, I'm not going to say 9/11 or something like that, but like, you know, when a plane hit, I mean, people must have been blown out of, like, it blew my mind, Sweeney, blew my mind. Wow. All I know is that I was on my hands and knees, and I thought this might be it. I didn't know if I'd make it out of there. I didn't know what was going on. I was just hysterical. I crawled to, like, the hallway, and then when it finally stopped, I was like, windows, walls, everything was like, I thought the building was coming down. It was 3 stories. I was on the second. So I thought, you know, I just remember thinking, oh, wow, I must have got a second chance, you know? I must have got a second chance because I just thought, holy shit, man, this could be it, you know?
Wow.
It was frightening. I remember being in the street 5:30 in the morning, and I was like, I couldn't. I was like, I guess we won't be filming today. You know, my agent was like,
yeah.
I can't believe this kid. Oh, my God, he just got here, and this happens. I'm like, welcome to California. And I was like, holy, this doesn't happen in New York. I'd only been here a short while, you know? And, you know, then the aftershocks for months and months and months. It was insane.
Wow.
It was insane. I mean, I can't even recreate it for you, but it was like, I could just tell you, you can't imagine what that's like.
Yeah.
It's like anything when you're in it. It's like when I almost drowned one time. It's like, you don't know that feeling till you go, oh my God, you know?
Crazy,
man. Crazy. I mean, I remember calling the producers, and they were like, one of the producers lived in a different area. He was like, well, what happened? I go, what do you mean, what happened? Where are you? Well, I'm in Brentwood. I said, well, I don't give a where you are. I said, man, I almost died.
Wow.
Man, you know, I almost got killed. So, but, you know, it was an experience that I'll never forget. You know, I remember I was in Life magazine. They took a picture of me, and I was like, David Caruso came looking for me. He was like, get out of the building, get out of the building. I said, I'm just going back to get some clothes. He goes, don't go in there. Do not go in there. And I was like, okay. I was like still walking around in shock. I was in shock. You know, I was completely in shock. You know, it's just, it's when things like that, you can't believe it's happening. It almost didn't feel real.
Wow. To bring it back to a little more happier memory for you, you got to be in all your glory as a Yankee fan in the late 90s. You're on TV and one of the biggest shows on TV, and the Yankees are now winning World Series like crazy. I'm curious, though, did the World Series in the late 90s interfere with your shooting schedule where you didn't get to enjoy watching the games as much? How did that work for you?
No, actually, 96 was pretty special because at the time, I had done these baseball commercials to ESPN. It was me and Abe Lincoln revitalizing baseball. I started making baseball connections. I had a lot of juice with the Yankees. I had some juice with Major League Baseball. So we happened to be in New York the week of the World Series. So I saw the first two games where the Yankees got blown out. 12-0, and then the second game it got like 4-0, 4-1, and then that week we were shooting exteriors while they were in Atlanta.
Okay.
So I watched all three games in my hotel room, screaming and yelling. The producers even heard one night on the floor. They said, "Holy mackerel! That must be that Nick. He must be going out of his mind." Because when they were down, the great game was Game four, the comeback with the Jim LaRich game. And so I was there that whole week in New York. So when they won the 1-0 game with Pettit, I said, you know, I'm going to game six too. So I was there for the clincher. I got on the field. I lost my voice. In fact, we were filming one day and I had no voice. I had dialogue and they go, "Nick, nothing's coming out," because I was yelling all week. And I was like, and everybody was coming to me for tickets on the show.
Yeah.
All the stars, ask Nick, see what Nick could do. All of a sudden, I had all the juice. And I was the man that week. My team was, here I was, you know, on TV, you know, with the show, 96. Oh, my God. And then I got on the field. They brought me in the locker room because Wade Boggs knew me. We did a commercial. Tori did a commercial with me on ESPN. These commercials, if I ever found them, you'd die laughing. They were very funny. They were funnier than the stuff ESPN's doing today. They weren't corny. They were well-produced. Anyway, I had done, you know, a funny bit with Wade Boggs. I did a funny bit with Tori about stealing the grass, and Tori called up Steinbrenner. He said, "George, we have the guy from the sod." You know, it was pretty funny. And so it was a euphoric week. Not only did my team win, I was on a TV show. I was in the lot. It was almost like a fantasy, Sweeney.
Yeah.
That 96 year, that 96 team in my life. And then, you know, I never imagined. I was just a kid. I mean, I was just a Yankee fan. I was just a hardcore, regardless of that I became an actor and known, I was a real fan. So that was just an unbelievable week and an unbelievable run those years. And 98, 99, 2000. Those were great years of my life, and great years has never quite been the same ever since then. And for the Yankees and for me.
I hope both of them get better for you.
Magic, and my life had magic going too. So it's weird, you know. You have times in your life where, and then, you know, you have peaks and valleys. The Yankees have had their moments. They had a championship in 2009. It's like my career. I had my moments, but, you know, it's weird. But, you know, that's life, man. That's life.
You were part of a dynasty once. That's all you can ask.
I was part of a dynasty, and you can't take that away from me.
So tell me what you're working on now. You sent me a trailer the other day for something called Over the Hill. Tell me a little bit about that, and what else you're working on.
Yeah, I've done a whole bunch of, like, independent movies the last couple of years. I mean, a lot of smaller movies. I had been in a bigger movie, Mall Cop 2, about a year or two ago.
Yep.
But then I've done a slew of these, like, independent films. But I've also, the last few years, I've been creating and developing stuff. I had a doorman pilot that I did on spec, like, a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, and I shot it in New York. It was kind of based on my doorman experiences, and it was interesting because I had a couple of development deals with that doorman show. I had one at HBO, and then I had one at FX with my brother. And my brother, who's more of a movie guy, was like, you know, listen to me, and we'll get it made, and We never got it made, and then I wound up developing it, writing it, directing it, and it wasn't bad. It was some good stuff in it. It wasn't perfect, but I learned a lot doing it, and it kind of inspired me to, you know, because I had years ago, after NYPD Blue, I had a couple of comedy pilots, one at CBS and one at the WB, you know, and first the WB, then CBS, and one the WB was outstanding. It was like an All in a Family, and it didn't get on the air, but it got me a deal at CBS, and then the one at CBS, I mean, long story short, I kind of got watered down. So those pilots, if they would have got on the air, I might have had my own show and could have been like, you know, the King of Queens, or Everybody Loves Raymond. I was very close to having my own show a few times. But, you know, the way the ball bounces is not always your way. But I learned a lot developing those. So when I did The Doorman, I kind of, you know, even my brother goes, well, why didn't you use my script? I was like, well, you know, your script never got made. So, you know, he's always been critical of me. But he's also very supportive.
Yeah.
And the show, that show, I didn't really shop it around a lot. It taught me some stuff. And like a year or two ago, I met this guy, Bentley Kyle Evans, who was the creator of Martin and the Jamie Foxx show. He's an old sitcom guy.
Okay.
And my son goes to school with his son. And, you know, he saw one of my old pilots and he said, listen, I'm shooting all these low-budget sitcoms. And he puts them on this smaller network called Bounce Television, and they do well, and he produces them, and he shoots like 12 in a month. I don't know how he does it, but he built these stages, and he goes, why don't we develop a show, like a guy who's, you know, not politically correct, a guy who's, you know. So I started thinking about, well, I did the Doorman thing, I learned a lot, why not base it on where I am now and what's next? And then basically the pilot is more based on, like, a guy who was in his 50s and he's like lived a life and he maybe was on top of the world once and now, you know, 50 something years old, he's got kids, you know, he inherits this pizzeria with his, and he's like, he once was an actor. You know, it's kind of somewhat based on me. And then he finds out he inherited this place and he's like, you know, with his sister who he can't stand and he hasn't seen in 5 years. And it's set out here in the valley. He kind of moved out here in his 20s and he's from New York, but it's more or less like a slice of life, a dramedy. It's a comedic show, but a single camera. We wanted to do it as a sitcom, but I said, you know what? That's not going to, I don't want it to be watered down. I see it more as a Netflix, Amazon. I see if I need to drop an F-bomb, I got to have some edge. I don't want to be, you know, but I think, you know, we wrote it, developed it, and then we shot it like a month or two ago. And now I've been tinkering with the sizzle and the Bible because we're trying to sell it. And the Bible would be like, you know, you lay out the next 10, 12 episodes. And I've been getting some great response on the little sizzle. I'm adding another second sizzle. I think it's got tremendous potential. My cousin Aida Turturro is in it. Tia Carrera plays the Filipino wife. Bentley's in it. So it's multi-ethnical, multi... You know, it's got a little bit of everybody in it, a little bit of race, a little bit of, you know, but I think it's a show that could be very universal because it's got something for everybody. But it's also like says, you know, hey, you know, there's room for a comedy like this. And you know, just because you're 50 something years old doesn't mean it's over. You know, it's like, you know, maybe, you know, this is a chance to reinvent yourself in a certain way and kind of, you know, So I'm very upbeat about it. I think it's I'm my mission right now is to try to get this thing sold, and you know, there's a movie out there too that I'd like to direct that we've been trying to get off the ground for a while. My friend Mark Kriegel, who's a great sports writer, who you probably know of, and we got this movie Bless Me Father that we've been trying to get made for a long time. And I think, you know, doing this pilot, I saw that wow, I could act and direct. Everybody was like, man, I was acting everybody's part out too. It was weird. I was like, I was acting everybody because I wrote it. So I kind of know how I want everybody to, you know, I know how, what I'm looking for, you know, I have it in my head. And, I think it kind of like, you know, inspired me to like say, like fall in love with acting again in a way, because you know, the last few years I've been just doing kind of jobs. You know what I mean? Like you're doing jobs to make money, to survive. And this was more like a passionate job. But when you do things for love, even when my career took off, I was doing things maybe I didn't make a lot of money at, but they helped. They gave me that you know, that zest again, that fire, you know, and I could tell I'm on to something with this show. You know, I don't want to just, you know, I always give it my best, but what I'm saying is, you know, this is a passion project, and, you know, I'm looking for a nice shot here. You know, you got to get on the air somewhere. Yeah. So, you know, everybody loves it so far, loves it. Even my brother, who's a tough critic, I think it's pretty good, Nick. So, you know, listen, man, I've had my ups and downs, but I know there's nobody out there like me, so, which is kind of cool. And I'm not overexposed, so I think it's coming. I think that next, you know, if this something like this gets on the air, it could help me also get the better, you know, because things are harder today. They're way harder, Sweeney. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, it's a different world. It's not always about what's good. Let me tell you, it's not always about what's good, you know, because, you know, reality television, and it's saturated. I mean, you're like, you know, look at network television. There's a lot of funny things on television, you know, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But that's just me, you know?
Well, Nicky, listen, I wish you lots of luck with this, and I hope it's a big success, and then you can come back on and do this again for me. How's that sound?
Sweeney, anytime, buddy. You're always a loyal friend and a good soldier, and keep doing a good job for the Yankees. And if you need a co-partner, co-pilot, I'm always there for you, buddy.
You're my guy. Thank you, Nick.
The Yankees are looking up, too. I'm excited. I'm excited about them.
They're on the upswing. You should be. We'll talk about that maybe later in the season. How's that sound?
All right. Let's do that again.
And my thanks again to Nick Turturro. Hopefully we get to see that new project Over the Hill, as well as that film he's trying to make with Mark Kriegel. For those who don't remember, Mark Kriegel was a terrific columnist for the New York Daily News for many years. He's also the author of a tremendous Joe Namath biography from a few years back. Anyway, thanks to Nicky, and hope to have him back another time. And thank you for listening as well. Check out our older episodes if you haven't already. You can search them on iTunes and subscribe for free. More good shows coming your way in the next few weeks. Thanks for listening.